Hello again and welcome to another episode of BitNote. We'll be talking about video game music and the games they're from, but also we might be looking a bit to the movies for this episode. Hope you enjoy. So, before I begin my show, I thought I'd tell you about another radio program that you guys would be interested in. It's not on Dublin South FM, this local community radio station in Dublin, Ireland, but rather it's on Clanisical Minnesota Public Radio in America, and the name of the program is Top Score by Emily Reese. And what she does is actually pretty interesting. She interviews various video game music composers. She's interviewed a lot of big names like people behind Dishonored and Red Dead Redemption, and recently I came across her when I was doing some research last week about Norman Corbell, the Canadian composer behind Heavy Rain, and I suddenly came across the show and I found there were a lot of pretty good programs about it. Just like with my show here, BitNote, if you don't happen to be within the specific radius of the radio transmission tower and in position of an FM radio in order to listen to the show, or if you just simply miss the shows, you can go online and listen to her podcasts, just like with my show, so that you can catch up on shows you missed or be able to listen to her in the first place if you don't happen to be nearby. She's got plenty of great podcasts online, and just to set you off, I think I'll play an extract from one of her shows. This is part of her interview with Norman Corbell, who unfortunately died about 2 weeks ago, and just to give you a bit of an idea of what her show is about, here it is.
I liked it very much. I liked the mix of the piano with the orchestra. And I mean, it's not like that's a new sound. We've heard it for centuries, mm-hmm. but it worked so well, I think, especially with the idea of rain falling, mm-hmm. and just how I think that sound just captured that idea
of
really,
course.
Really well. Yeah.
But yeah. The piano, what is beautiful with the piano is it is an old instrument, but at the same time, a really modern instrument. And you can do so many things with this and all generation, you know. You don't have to get an electric guitar to touch young people. A piano will touch everybody. So I think mm-hmm. it's really a universal instrument.
So in Heavy Rain, there are around, I've heard estimates of about 60 to 65 chapters through mm-hmm. the game. And you may or may not, as a player, play all of those chapters, but there are also something like 20 or 22 different ways to end the game. So did you have to score additional music for scenes that a player might never even see or hear?
Probably. I don't remember how many cues I've done, but I think it was close to almost 300 cues. What I've done with Quantic Dreams, the way we proceed is, you know, work with teams and different variation of stress or sadness and et cetera, et cetera. Of course, we have done a lot of different ending, and that was the huge difference between movie and video game, because it was exactly the same process. But you have to do 10 or 20 endings, so it's quite different. It's really interesting for a composer, because sometimes you're working on a movie, you think that maybe it would be interesting if the scene would finish like this or would finish like that. And mm-hmm. on a video game, you get it, you know? So you have
yes.
you can really explore a bit more about the team, because you can do in a so different way that it could really be a huge challenge to do.
We'll be right back.
And that was an extract from Top Score, which was hosted by Emily Rees, who in that extract was interviewing Norman Corbell, the composer behind Heavy Rain, which was developed by Quantic Dream, and David Cage. So, if you liked what you heard, check out the show. Like I said, it's pretty good, and it obviously gives you like really upfront things with a lot of these great composers. Moving on to our next piece of music, I think I'll just go back to basics and just play a piece of music from a great video game and then talk about the game. Sound good to everyone? I think you might like this track. And what you just heard there was Space Cruise, also the title music, and was composed by Ben Prunty from the game FTL, which stands for Faster Than Light, and it's by Subset Games. FTL has a very interesting story behind it. It kind of got popularity on the internet when it was an early Kickstarter success. Now, you probably know about Kickstarter. It's basically a crowdfunding platform where people say their games, say how much money they're looking for, and basically people from all around the world will say, decide whether or not they like the game, and then pledge a bit of money, and in return they might get a copy of the game or some other bonus benefits and all this sort of stuff. It's a whole gigantic issue. It's not really that straightforward, and of course it can easily be unsuccessful. But to cut a long story short, FTL was one of the earlier games to go for it. They asked for $10,000 to finish the game. They had a good concept, good pitch, explained exactly what they needed it for. They just needed a few things to finish up the game. And then they ended up getting over $200,000 pledge. Boy. I'm still not entirely sure how it happened. I think just a lot of people really liked the idea and the concept and everything. And within about a month or two after the Kickstarter, of course, the game was released. So apparently not even all that money was needed to finish the game in the first place. And I think the guys are going to go on and use that money for good stuff in their next game. But the point is, FTL came out and people did very much like it. And of course, one of the things they liked about it was that music. It's kind of funny, actually. In the original Kickstarter, they said, yes, part of the reason we need part of this $10,000 is so that we can pay Ben Brunty the money he needs. You know, he's been making music for this game, and he's kind of been doing it, you know, for more or less for free or at a low price, but would really like to be able to play this guy. And suddenly they get $200,000 for the game. Yeah, I think by that stage, Ben Brunty should be looked after at that stage. I mean, I don't think that bill is going to go unpaid, in it, is what I'm saying. But anyway, as you can see, a lot of atmospheric music. There's a lot of great things like that, whether both plays at the beginning, plays at the end, and many different scenarios of the game have their own track. But enough with the great music. What exactly is FTL about? Long story short, it's kind of a spaceship simulator of sorts. It's not one of those hugely in-depth, tactical things like a flight simulator or anything. Nothing near that low level. But it's like, you know, those TV programs you'd used to watch, like, you know, I don't know, Red Dwarf, or some people say Battlestar Galactica, but I've never actually seen that one, so I'm not sure I should really be mentioning that one. But a bunch of other things where you've basically got a nice little crew of misfits in this ship with an impossible mission, so they venture off into the great unknown, charting in uncharted courses and finding strange, new, exciting adventures every week. But so essentially, FTL is kind of like that. You've got a small ship, you've got a small group, and apparently you're members of this federation who have been, you know, practically destroyed by the rebels, but you have knowledge of a weakness in the rebel mothership, and you need to make it to the end in order to find that weakness. The odds you face in the game seem to be nigh impossible. And it's, unfortunately, that means a different thing in video games than it does in TV. Because while in TV land, nigh impossible means very suspenseful, but completely will actually be accomplished, in video games, nigh impossible means huge and huge amounts of frustration as you try to figure out the one single combination that will get you through to the end. Because FTL is kind of a difficult game, which is actually, I think, to its benefit, but there's always some whiners out there. The point is, apologies to the whiners, I know sometimes you just want to enjoy yourself, but still. Long story short, it's like, when I first started this game, I thought, this is great. I'll name the spaceship, it lets you name the spaceship. I'll select custom names for all the crew and individualize them, and I thought this was great. And I just got into the whole, like, role-playing thing of getting the ship and pretending that I've got this crew. And so you start up the game. It starts, you're told quickly, a text pops up explaining your mission, which is pretty much always the same, and then, okay, I've got to keep going through all the space sectors, and you get the star map where you basically click on a star, and each time you warp to that point, something happens, and you deal with it, and then you click to the next one, and it's basically kind of like almost like hopping from stepping stone across this pond, and when you get to the end of the pond, you get the next one, except in these cases, space sectors. So I jump to the next star, and I get some damage, and maybe an event happens, which I react to, and maybe that there's suddenly a ship and I have to learn how to use the battle systems, and then suddenly it seemed to be going okay and I think I've got the gist, and then suddenly I get destroyed and all the crew dies and I feel kind of pissed off. So I press the restart button and my crew is back, and their names are all there again, and I assign them to their different parts in the ship, and then I move out again and I think, okay, I think I know what I did this time. I blast, and suddenly there's a fire on the ship and it's suddenly burning really fast. And I'm wondering, well, this is awkward. And gradually the fire spreads, and I desperately try to fight it, but I can't, and it swamps the whole ship and they die. And okay, so I try again, and next time the fire does break out, and this time I think, this is a great idea. I know, I'll open up the airlock doors. This will create a hard vacuum that'll extinguish the fires, and then they'll be fine. And I open the doors, and then it extinguishes the fire, and then it also extinguishes my crew members, because they end up dying of suffocation because I opened the doors and ejected all the air. So then I try again, and I'm a little more strategic about it. But of course, inevitably, what happens is that I open the doors, and but the fire goes out. But this is only after it's damaged the door control system, so I can't close the doors again, and I have to send my crew members on a suicide mission to try to repair a door control system in a hard vacuum. Gradually, I'm just trying to work things out. It's a constant cycle of learning. I try to figure out, okay, what I need to do is just get to the end of the sector as fast as possible, which I do before anything bad happens. But then the next sector I find out more powerful enemies, and they beat the heck out of me. So then I try to spend more time exploring, and I find more weapons and everything, and try to upgrade the ship and defeat all these enemies. And then I manage to get powerful lasers, and I'm able to blast the enemies. But then they've got some defense against the lasers by having really powerful shields, and they send out drones at me. The whole game is kind of like a weird version where you've got to be defensive on a lot of things at the whole time. If you spend all your time, you can basically defeat enemies and upgrade your ships or find more weapons and install them to the ships. But if you spend too much time on the weapons, you'll neglect the shields, and they'll just manage to break through and damage your weapon system. And if you spend all the time dealing with the shields, you might forget to neglect the doors in the ship, and then they'll be able to beam across crew members, and then they'll be able to... It's just, the whole game has so many, a couple of different mechanics to it, a couple of things going on at once, and things can just get very frantic as you're trying to multitask and all the different tasks that you're doing, trying to, basically, you can move your crew members about the ship to fight, you can upgrade, you know, weapon systems, you can send out drones that attack the ship, or drones that defend the ship, or drones that go into the other enemy ship and try to kill everyone else. But it's just, or you can upgrade your shields and just work that out. But no matter what combination you have, if there's any weakness in your defense or how you've outfitted the ship, then sooner or later you'll hit some person that's able to just extract and pounce on that exact weakness, and then you're kind of screwed, and you have to still spend as much time you can upgrading the ship. Now, it just... And then every time the ship blows up, you have to start from the beginning. It sounds tough, it sounds hard, but that's how it is. Some people say it's like NetHack. I kind of think it's more like those old arcade games where, you know, you play and get as far as you could, and if you screwed up, then you go back. When you start off, you'll be playing a game for like 15 minutes. But when you really get experienced, before you die, but when you really get experienced, it can last 2 hours as you're just desperately trying to find every single strategy. And it's just very, very clever. It's one of the few games where you're trying to get better as you go along, where all the mechanics are laid out in front of you, and you have to try to understand it, you have to try to develop it, you have to just figure out the best combination, the best weapons, and take chances. Now, it's obviously that I like this game very much, and maybe I even got a little addicted to it at one stage. But it was just good trying to find the combinations. But you might be thinking, okay, this is all very mechanical, but what about what I was saying at the beginning about how these are all human beings, and, you know, you're venturing off to far-flung universes like in those TV shows? Well, the truth is, after you start dying a few times, I started thinking of them less as crew members and more as my loyal servants who must not fail me and must still succeed in the ship. They die so often, and especially some of the earlier games were so short, it was hard to draw an attachment to them. And sometimes they'd die and you'd get crew members that would replace them, especially aliens, which would be pretty cool. And it's just so, you know, it's like, okay, sorry about that. I guess you'll just have to, you know, it's just, I'm sorry, I don't want to get too attached. You'll probably die, and then I'll probably find some alien who might be able to do your job better. So, sorry about that. It doesn't help that restarting is the only way to get your original crew back, and then if you try to create a new crew or change your ship or anything, all the original crew members you had there are lost forever, unless you want to recreate them from the beginning. And it also didn't help that one time when I was just restarting my crew, it turned out some of the crew members changed gender. I'm assuming that bug has been fixed in the meantime, but it's still, there you have it. But in the end, it still kind of works out because you still get a diverse crew at the beginning and there's still a lot of little events that happen throughout the game and it just depends on what's happening next. I hear there's actually a fan film that's actually based on a FTL and I mean, it's got plenty of rich material. The plot in FTL is very minimalist. Most of it's through text screens and you might have decisions like such as whether to send an away team down to a planet to investigate something or something, and the effect of that decision will be shown in another text screen. Bit of text, but its minimalist approach still just seems to be enough to let your imagination flow. So it is nice how it sets up these scenarios, but just it's sometimes you're just so driven to just say again, get through it, get to the last sector, defeat the mothership, that you're sort of seem to view your crew as slightly expendable. Well, not too expendable because you need people to man those machine rooms, but still need. You're not exactly ready to invite them to your own birthday party. Alright, I think that's enough for that game. FTL, of course, is purchasable for Windows, Mac, and Linux, and is a great and on most online distribution purchasing platforms and stuff. So, now for our next thing, we're actually not going to talk about something specifically that's a video game, but video game related. It has been, in the last few days, Wreck-It Ralph was released, and it was released in Europe, despite the fact it was released several months before in America, and I heard everyone online talking about how great the movie was, and I was going, great, when are you yet to see it? And I had to look up and realize I had to wait several months and was kind of pissed. But such is the way it sometimes happens, and I finally got to see it, and I was pretty happy with it. The movie Wreck-It Ralph, of course, is, when I heard about Wreck-It Ralph first, it was almost like a movie that I always wanted to make or dreamed about making as a kid. It's pretty much very natural to come up with this thing. You play all these great games and have so many cool characters and so many things associated with it. You just imagine kind of like a story where all these characters get together and go on adventures. Well, Wreck-It Ralph isn't quite like that. The main characters, most of the action and plot focuses around these original video game characters and what they do. And, of course, the whole setup is that it's set up in an arcade with all these arcade machines able to communicate with each other through this great big extension cord that they're all plugged into. And it stars Wreck-It Ralph, who's the bad guy in a game called, in a 1982 video game called Fix-It Felix. And he every day he's beaten by Fix-It Felix, which is strange because in real arcade machines, the bad guy wins nearly all the time. And it's the few exceptions the good guy wins. In fact, sometimes the bad guy wins all the time. But the point is, he basically gets tired of being the bad guy. So he wants to, through a set of events, he suddenly sees an opportunity to go out, prove that he's the hero. And in the respect of an admiration of all the NPC characters in the game that he's usually fighting against. To do this, he travels between video games, which he's able to do because all the arcade machines in the arcade place are actually plugged in, and he's able to, and a lot of game characters are also able to transfer back and forth. And this is where you see a lot of the cool cameos or from various characters, like a lot of the ones from Street Fighter, and of course Sonic is there too, which is actually justified because in the beginning of the movie, you do actually see a Sega Sonic the Hedgehog arcade cabinet briefly at one point. But the key thing about the movie in regards to the characters is that it treats a lot of these game characters with a lot of respect and, you know, treats, there are things like from Q-Bert and Pac-Man and everything. And it's just, there's even like a zombie, which I seemed like very like one of the ones from House of the Dead too. So, and a lot of the little references really just work in the context of the movie and just, It seems like a great homage. It was actually cool seeing all these characters like this and all excited about it. But then I suddenly started to realize a lot of the people watching this movie are kids who probably didn't grow up with a lot of these characters. So it's kind of, I know there are a lot of retro game compilations out there, but sometimes I just wonder, you know, what sort of movie are they seeing? You know, I'm seeing sort of one movie that does great tributes to a lot of different classic video games and seeing the resurrecting characters that I remember from my childhood and everything. But what do they see when they weren't really even alive to see these characters in the first place, where all the whole 80s with the arcade machines and all the video games that have developed since then are just ancient history to them, and they just see video games as they pop up now? It's just pretty interesting as well. I mean, the fact that the movie is even set in an arcade place in the first place. I mean, it actually came as no surprise when I found out that the origins for this movie were made back in the 80s, when that's when the idea for this sort of movie first came up. These days, arcades are far more endangered. They are places where they resurrect or a place where you can still get arcade cabinets. And actually, in fact, I think the movie did a great job in the beginning of the movie. They had this fast-forward montage sequence from the 80s to modern day, showing how the arcades changed and the spaces begin to open up with the arcade. And at one point you see like an enclosed driving place that were pretty popular during the enclosed driving arcade machine that was pretty popular during the 90s. And then towards the end you even have the Dance Dance Revolution things and the great big screen light gun games, which they called first person shooters, which I always think is a completely different genre because it's light gun game. But let's stop painting on and on about it. But I suppose if there's one thing I'd say about the movie, it's the movie doesn't entirely depend on these video game references, which is great at one stage because it needs to stand on its own two feet. And the character of this video game bad guy trying to find his way and make the decisions to improve his life is actually a pretty good story. But at the same time, a lot of the movie is spent in this sugar kingdom where they spend more time making jokes about candy and sweets rather than they do actual video games, which kind of surprised me since the marketing of this movie was always heavy into the retro video games. But I don't know, it's still a fun movie and I'll let it slide. Now I think I'll finish off by playing a track from that movie. The movie of course has a pretty expansive soundtrack. It's a more expansive soundtrack than I'm used to when just dealing with video games, and there's a lot of great songs to choose from. There is, of course, a song by Owl City, which I do like a lot. There's one by Bruckner and Garcia, who happened to make this hit song in America called Pac-Man Fever. I don't know if it was a hit over here, but it was basically kind of a novelty song based around Pac-Man, and it was very popular, so they ended up making a song based in Wreck-It Ralph, which is pretty cool. There's also a song by Rihanna. Yeah, I'm really, really sure she needs more exposure, and I'm sure this show is the perfect opportunity for her to actually get that sort of exposure. And there's also a track by this band called AKB48, which is a Japanese girl band that has 88 members. It's actually a pretty good song they've got there. But there's also a song by Skrillex. Yep. One of these days I will understand dubstep, but today is not one of those days. So with all these selection, I went through it and I decided to settle on one piece of music that was actually made by the composer that was assigned to actually make the game's music, make the film's music. In other words, the person who was actually responsible for the soundtrack. His name is Henry Jackman. He's a British composer. He's made music for a lot of movies, including X-Men First Class and Winnie the Pooh and Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter. And essentially, he made an extremely diverse set of music for this film. I obviously had a bit of trouble choosing a track, but I think I settled on a track called Wreck-It Ralph. It's Wreck-It Ralph, just like the movie title. It's, I think, a good track because not only does it represent the guy who was working the music for this film, but I think it's a good track in and of itself, and it's got subtle music inspirations from video game music for this track, but at the same time I think it also represents something of the spirit of the film itself, so that's the one I've chosen. By the way, normally I don't promote online music services, but I was able to buy the soundtrack for this film from 7digital.ie, which not only gave the full tracks in unencumbered MP3 format, but also was available to sell this to me in Ireland. So, with that, this has been David Collins with BitNote. Thanks for listening, and remember, the previous show I mentioned was Top Score by Emily Reese.